So, this is being recorded. There are a few people, as it is, has become the custom, that message me that they cannot come but would love to hear about it. So, this is for them as well. Okay. The purpose of this year is to discuss a topic that I would say is not often discussed in typical Torah environments. Maybe once guys get to yeshiva, it comes up. Maybe in some more Hasidic or Kabbalistic circles, it comes up. But beyond that, the word shovavim is not a... I would say, again, speaking on average, Klal Yisrael is not typically a well-known concept. The word Shovavim refers to a pasuk in Navi, Shuvu Banim Shovavim. And it's referring to, obviously, the process or the prophecy of the Jewish people to do tshuva, that we're far away and we should be returning. The word Shovavim is also referring to this specific time of year. Why are we talking about Tshuva in the middle of January, in the middle of Shvat, or Teves, right? Why? Because when we start Sefer Shmos, we are starting a specific process that Klal Yisrael went through, that we're reading about in the Parsha, a process that began with Avdus, and it ended with Matan Torah. And if you think about what that process is, besides it being historical fact, besides it being the story of our heritage, on a spiritual level, it's a process of incredible tshuva, an incredible spiritual transformation from a place of, I wouldn't say ignorance, it's not really a matter of ignorance, a place of lowliness, of low spirits, a place of feeling very disconnected. When we talk about Avdus, there is a turning point specifically, and this is mentioned in the Haggadah, and you see the course of events in Sefer Shmos, that this is the turning point. It's when the Jewish people cried out, they screamed out, Vanitzak. And that's when immediately afterwards it says that Hashem saw their pain, he heard their cry, and that's when he decided this is the time that I'm going to bring them out. And a scream is a very interesting thing. There is no coincidence that that sound is related to the Tekiyah Shofar, about a cry, a call. But a scream is really from a place, if you think about it, of desperation, a kind of hopelessness, right? Think about it this way. If you're trying to get help as an adult, you plan, you communicate effectively. If you're trying to get a job, you don't just say, right? You try and fill out a resume. You try and network. You attend a workshop. You look around at what resources are available. When an adult is screaming, it means they're at a point where they feel so far away from practical modes of support and help, where they feel extremely disconnected. And on a spiritual level, the same is true. When you want to spiritually connect, you have avenues by which you can do that. There are ways by which you could express yourself, draw yourself closer, but if it's in terms of a simple scream, it means that from a very basic level, you feel so far away that you don't feel like you're capable of accessing what you're trying to access. And there are several Hasidic stories, some of which you may have heard of, like the boy in Shul who was davening in the back of shul, yelling out the Aleph Beis. Have you heard of that story? And the Baal Shem Tov stopped everyone and said, this is the only tefillah that's going up to the highest parts of the heavens. And he was illiterate and he didn't know how any of the words of the Siddur. And all he knew in his whole life, he was just this ignorant boy. All he knew was the Aleph Beis. So he was yelling, Aleph Beis Gimel. But in his mind, he was thinking this is the... And the Baal Shem Tov, of course, understood the power of simply trying to get, but that's already when you have something to work with, even though if it's very minimal. the idea of a scream is we're so far away, and to think that we went from that place to looking at God, whatever that even means, to being able to experience God in a physical manifestation, again, something that's hard for us to even understand, and to receive the Torah, which we totally take for granted we have to, because we don't know what a world is without Torah, without order, without a way of connecting spiritually through physical activity, through this world. We went from the farthest of the far to literally as close as it possibly gets, and perhaps even closer, because our lives were taken from us several times in the process because it was too intense. And that is the most successful tshuva story you could think of. And that's the process that we're reading about right now on a national level. But it means that there's an opportunity here for us to replicate that or emulate that process on an individual level. And it is hinted to in the letters Shmos, Va'era, Bo, Beshalach, Yisro, Mishpatim, which the first letter of each parsha spell out Shovet. If that wasn't understood yet, this is the origin of what this word means, what this concept is, why it's relevant right now, and what we need to focus on when we're going. So now, that's a very broad idea, tshuva, right? We're familiar, again, when it comes to Elul and Tishrei, the Yom Noraim, the process of tshuva is very comprehensive. There's very little that's left out. But there's actually something more specific that is focused on when it comes to the idea of Shovavim. And it's based on a Gemara in Eiruvin. The Gemara in Eiruvin says that after the sin of Adam and Chava, Adam separated himself from Chava for 130 years. Kind of awkward if there's no one else in the world to say, you know, we're not going to be together, like, what else? There's no one really else to hang out with. And during that time, there was evil that seeped into the world as a result of that separation. And the Gemara explains that that evil that came into the world was the result of one specific thing. It was the result of, over the course of that time, sperm left Adam's body, obviously not in an act of intercourse, and that was seen as a terrible sin, and it caused evil to enter the world. Kind of random, kind of a weird Gemara story, right? And it's very hard to understand, what does that mean? The basic understanding is that this wasn't on purpose, that this wasn't a sin, that this was accidental, and therefore, what are we talking about? Evil happening as a result of an accident. And the takeaway from the Gemara, according to many, is that the accidental releasing of sperm in that incident was the result of impure thoughts that, again, happened overnight in a dream that he wasn't intentionally thinking, but having impure thoughts in the middle of the night in a dream is the result of thinking less than pure thoughts over the course of one's day. And that whole process begins with there being something not quite right in one's daily thoughts, or at least in regards to Adam. And it resulted in a sin happening, albeit unintentional. But it can be traced back to something that perhaps could have been controlled. Again, the obscurity of it, the strangeness of the subject. But this is the Gemara that many choose to understand what should be, what midah of ours, what character trait, what value should be focused on specifically when it comes to Shovavim. The controlling of our thoughts to whatever extent possible, what goes in and out of our thoughts. And I want to shed light on this idea just for a few minutes, again, not going into too much depth. I want it to remain as practical as possible. with some background and hopefully a way of us arriving at a way where we can see that this is more relevant than ever nowadays. And I don't mean because of the obvious things of how there's a lot of sexuality is just overly expressed in our generation. We're not the first generation to have that, but it's certainly not an exception. That is just everywhere. Not just in terms of that, but really in terms of the idea of controlling what's in our mind in general, as a way of serving God, as that being part of the religious expression. So I want to go back to the Adam and Chava story, because it's kind of interesting that this whole topic started with Adam and Chava and this random story. Now, that sin that caused him to separate from his wife, or that was what immediately preceded him separating from Chava, that sin is also a very interesting sin. Like many stories in the Chumash, on the surface it seems very clear-cut, black and white. God said, don't do that thing, and they did that thing, sin, right? And then you dig a little deeper and you realize the story is kind of strange, that it's this Nachash character that convinced Chava, who then tried it and convinced Adam, and then he tried it, and then then God went to Adam, and then Adam said she did it, and then she said that the snake did it, and then he punished the snake, and then he punished Chava, and then he punished Adam. It's like kind of a strange... Yeah, it really sounds very immature, and there are those that want to say that that was a large part of the sin, the unwillingness to take responsibility for those actions. It sounds immature, it sounds strange, it also, like just thinking practically, like you live in an orchard of sorts, a perfect garden where everything is for you, and you just said, don't eat that tree, like... Was this simply like, I gotta know, you know, is it that simple, like, that he's just curious? So we know that this tree had some special, again, hard to define, and I'm not going to be one that claims that I can answer the questions behind this whole event, but it was called the Eitz Hadas, right? And we know that that meant it wasn't just like an apple tree. It wasn't just that you ate it and you had special powers. There was something here that is way beyond our ability to understand. But I heard it explained in one specific way. Have you guys heard of the idea that this Nachash character actually represented something? What did he represent?
The Yetzer Hara.
The Yetzer Hara. And what that means is, on a very practical level, is that when Adam and Chava, or specifically Chava, was having a conversation with this serpent, this snake type of character, and that character represents or manifests, is the manifestation of the Yetzer Hara, it means that Chava was having a conversation with the Yetzer Hara. And that was, it was external to her, as if it was a conversation with another being, and it was. And that experience is not one we're used to, because when we see someone drop $20 as they're walking or running away and you see it, that conversation that you have is internal, right? They will never know, I really need a new pair of shoes, things like that, right? And you have to have this very quick conversation in your head, and hopefully the right side wins. But when it's someone else, a voice outside of you talking, it's much more clearly defined what is good and what is bad. I think, again, think about if that voice telling you no one's going to know or she's not going to know, I really want shoes, well, it's just a person right next to you. And the only voice inside of you was it's wrong. That voice would be, that conversation would go very differently. I know it's wrong. No, but think about it. come on. I don't know. It's probably a creepy sounding guy, right? But I imagine that that conversation is much more easy to navigate when you don't have to convince yourself of something. You're already convinced of what's right. Now, Chazal say that what happened when they ate from the Eitz Hadas Tovara was that the Yetzer Hara was transferred from being a physical being outside of them to being inside of them. Now, what it means essentially to not have a Yetzer Hara inside of you is that you know that something is objectively wrong or objectively right. Right? It's a cat. I'm pretty sure it's a cat. Yeah. There was one shear recently where there was a cat staring at me from outside the window, like for half the shear. Yeah. I'm like, maybe it's a Gilgul of a Tzaddik or something. Yeah. Yeah. It's the worst. Anyways. Oh, there it goes. Now, what it means to not have a Yetzer Hara inside of you is that you're not conflicted when it comes to issues of ethics, of right and wrong. Because you don't need to wonder what I should do in this case. You know. Again, it's something we're not familiar with because we don't know what life is like without a Yetzer Hara. We feel that it's part of what it means to be human, and it is. But there was a time, it was only for a few couple hours in existence, where that wasn't part of what it meant to be human. And what it meant to be human at that time was you were inherently given a moral compass of what was right, what was true, and you didn't need to wonder, you weren't conflicted about it. What happens when the Yetzer Hara enters? It means my knowledge is now not clear. My knowledge is kind of less relevant, what I know. Because now I can think of what I know in two different ways. Right? That $20 belongs to that person. That is knowledge. What I should do with that knowledge is now not clear. It used to be clear because I was aligned. Knowledge and truth was aligned with my morality, with my yetzer, my inclination. But now that I have two inclinations, that knowledge stands over there, and now I have to approach it in two different ways and navigate that dilemma. Now, if you think about what that is on a purely conceptual level, it means I have added more thoughts to my head, and it made my ability to navigate my life worse. Think about that. I've increased my knowledge, so to speak, and I have decreased my ability to use that knowledge. It's kind of like when there are 8 different choices of peanut butter, and you're like, I just want, you know, just peanut butter. Why can't I just choose peanut butter? And it's like Skippy low fat, the chunky with the high whatever with honey in it, and all those different, right? I don't know if that's a great example. There are lots of things that have a ton of choices. And there is actually a study done, there's a TED talk on YouTube, you could check it out, that scientifically speaking, it's good to have choices, because it means that you could prioritize and you could choose what is more fitting for you, and you're happier with a choice if you make a choice over something else. But if it goes beyond a certain amount of choices, I think the number is maybe 5 or 6, scientifically, statistically speaking, choices become bad, because then you don't feel good about your choice, because you are always thinking, what if maybe that one was better? And you end up regretting it most of the time, even if you did make the right choice, and you're not settled with your choice. So the more knowledge you have, think about it, why wouldn't you want to choose from 20 different shades of blue for your wall? Wouldn't it be better to have more choices? We usually think that it's better, but our mental capacity, the way that we were built as human beings, is we want choice, but not too much choice. We want knowledge, but not too much knowledge. It's not good for us to know that there's more to a certain extent. And what happened with Eitz HaDaas, and think about what it meant that Adam internalized Daas, He wanted to be, again, there's lots of talk that I don't want to get into, but he wanted to be like Hashem, he wanted to be immortal, he wanted to know the beyond, he didn't want to have any limitation. We don't have to enter that world, but to increase knowledge for the sake of enhancing your existence, in this case, ended up doing the opposite. Brought another perspective, brought another ability to think about their lives that they didn't have previously, and it made life worse. Just as an example, so it could be that the root of the problem was, if I know more, or if I don't appreciate my ability to be precise in the way I'm thinking, to care deeply about what I let into my mind and what I don't. If I don't take that seriously, then I'm going to lead to sin. And maybe, if you think about it, God was saying, by putting an Eitz Hadas, Tovara, in the middle of the garden, I give you a lot of knowledge, Adam, a lot. There's just something that you're not supposed to have in your head, something that's supposed to stay out of there. And there was maybe a part of Adam that said, I don't even care if it's not good for me. I just want to increase my knowledge, without necessarily caring if it's precisely what is right or wrong or what I need. And that lack of understanding that my limitation is actually good for me, that keeping something out of my head is actually good for me, that lack of sensitivity to that is perhaps what led to the sin in general. It led to his desire to want to eat from the Eitz Hadas to begin with. And perhaps that's the same symptom of over the course of that 130 years where that evil was allowed to enter the world, because he let his mind drift to places where it wasn't supposed to go, and that was also a lack of sensitivity to what should be in my head and what shouldn't. This is a fundamental concept in Yahadut. The concept of precision. There's a famous medrash that talks about how the whole sin of Adam and Rishon was because of a chumrah. Have you ever heard of that? It's a medrash that says that God said, don't eat from the Eitz Hadas. But Adam and Chava decided, I don't remember which one of them it was that created the chumrah. It might have been Adam that said, oh, I don't want to eat from the Eitz Hadas. Let's say we're not allowed to touch it. Let's build the fence around so we won't touch it. And that chumrah eventually led to this mental breakdown that led to them eating it. And the idea of chumrah and kula is interesting. It's not the topic of this year, but think about what chumrah and kula is. It's adding one way or the other to something that was already set for us. God said, do it this way, and we're saying, I'm going to do it a little more, or I'm going to do it a little this way. And we feel at times we're adding that will enhance our experience or will be more correct or more precise. And there are Isurim of one famously called Baal Tosif. Do not add. There's a prohibition to add. You're not allowed to sit in a sukkah a day longer than sukkahs. It's usur. You're not allowed to build a kosher sukkah and sit in it. Obviously, we know what it means to be more makel than it's supposed to. That's simply not following. But to say, I'm going to be more from than God, so to speak, and I'm going to do the mitzvah more than what God said, no. There's such a thing as too much in regards to spirituality. And what does that mean? What's the message behind that? Is that true godliness is preciseness. It means more is not better. I understand less is not better, but more is also not better. Being able to choose, I don't want that much, I don't want that little. That is, in essence, what mitzvot are. It's being for the reason why halacha is so intricate and elaborate and complex is because we're trying to find the precise method of acting. And if we could just throw kulas and chumras around, we could erase all of this doubt and all of these issues that this rabbi says this and that. Let's just all just wear the same clothes and keep the same everything. But it needs to be precise. And by the way, that issue with chumrah still lasts to this day. there are entire communities of Jews that feel that the other ones are completely non-Jewish because of the way they act, and it's all a matter of one community is more machmir in a few different things. And every single Jew in the entire conversation keeps all 613 mitzvahs the way that God asked us. And that's the power, unfortunately, the evil power of chumras. We think that putting more on is us serving God more, and it's not. Now, there are times where chumras are okay. Don't quote me like, oh, the rabbi said I don't have to, right? That's not what this is about. Now, this stems from a very basic concept, a very basic word, an important word in our lives. That word is kadosh. What does that word mean?
Holy.
Holy.
Separated.
Any other? We have one other opinion in the room.
I was going to say
holy. Holy. Two holies and a separated. Now, holy is, if we were to family feud this question, is the number one answer on the board. I don't mean the number one correct answer, but the most often answered response, the most popular answer. Holy. Now I have a follow-up question for you guys. What does holy mean? What does that mean?
Special.
Very special. What does it mean to be special? Important.
Greater.
What?
Greater than average.
To be greater than average. Okay, we're getting somewhere. Can you be special if you're like everyone else exactly? I don't mean like politically correct or incorrect. I'm just saying if we're trying to define the term. If you are exactly in every way like everyone like you, then, right? If you see a bunch of dogs that look exactly the same and bark exactly the same, they're same size, height, and everything, is one of them special? No, they can't be. There has to be some quality to that thing that makes them, yotzei min haklal, different, which is how you end up arriving at answer number two on the board, which is the word separated. Now, how did you arrive at separated?
Because I've learned something about this before, about
Kadoshim to you.
And once
good.
Said,
you quoted Rashi.
Holy, so.
You quoted Rashi. Rashi says to. Rashi defines the word Kadoshim to you. There's a big controversy among the commentaries what this word Kadoshim means, or actually what it's referring to. The Ramban points out, is this a mitzvah? Like, is this one of the 613 mitzvahs? Be holy? How do I fulfill this mitzvah? Do I, like, live in a mikvah for a week? Like, what do I do? And he had to define it as a certain thing, right? Rashi goes a more simplified route, and he says, yeah, it means perushim, which means separated. And it means min ha'arayot, from immorality, from inappropriate relationships. The Ramban's problem with that is we already have a mitzvah for that. It's called inappropriate relationships. That's already written somewhere. So why would God say that here, right? Okay, interesting topic. But it's interesting how Rashi used that word, which we know as the word holy. That's like everyone knows that word. And he said, no, it doesn't mean holy. It means separate. It means you should remove yourself from the category of immorality, from the identity of immorality. And it's almost as if, what does it mean to be kadosh? To remove yourself from inappropriate, illicit relationships. I heard it defined very well by Rav Moshe Targan, so Ram in Yeshiva Gush Etzion. The only term we can use to describe God, there's only one word that we could describe him with. And it's the word not. Not this. Not me. Not you. Not this world. Not trees. Not air. We know lots of things. The one thing we don't know is God. And therefore, the only thing we can attribute to him is our lack of understanding of him. Not. Now, if you combine that idea with the word kadosh, and the way we understand now what kadosh is, what holiness is, Holiness isn't like long beard or mystical. Holiness simply means separated from what we know to be reality. What we experience as reality, holy just means it's beyond that. And we associate with that more importance. We associate that better, right? Because we know that it means, when we're discussing spirituality, it's an elevated form of, more elevated, more transcendent from where we are. But the very fundamental essence of what it means to be holy is to say, I am able to remove myself from something. I'm able to separate myself from something that is here. And for me to be involved or to be connected to everything is for me to relinquish my holiness, because that's not what the word is. The word means there is something and I've separated from it. Holiness and FOMO do not go well together, right? The idea that, like, I need to experience everything or be, right? Holiness is saying the opposite. Like, I have no fear of being separate from that, from whatever it is, right?
Missing out.
No, I know the acronym, but whatever it is that's beyond that I shouldn't be a part of, I have no interest in connecting. I'm deliberately trying to remove myself. I have found in my experience in life, through my own life, through my kids, through my family, through clients that I see privately, that people often can be categorized in terms of their challenges, their struggles, into two different categories. One is people who struggle with not being able to be involved in something and wishing that they would be able to. You could apply that to a relationship, you could apply that to a job, to family, to friends, to spirituality even. And then there's the other category of people who aren't good at putting boundaries up in their life and removing themselves from things that they already are involved in. Do you see how that's the opposite struggle? People who wish that they would have a successful relationship, and people who are too involved in a relationship to the point where it's inappropriate or where it gets out of hand, where it's not good. And what's challenging is that we often look at people who are too involved as like, great, like I wish that would be my problem. I would have too many relationships to deal with, right? Or I'd have too many job offers. I'd be too good at, you know, making money, too much money. I wish that was my problem. And I have to know how to stop making money or how to put all my extra money, right? I pray to have that huge problem in my life. We know, though, in the first paragraph of Maseilas Yesharim that he describes that our challenge in this world is how to successfully use this world as a means of getting to the next world, which is where the ultimate pleasure in dvekus and in connecting to God exists. And that means in this world, we are constantly presented with challenges that we need to navigate and we need to successfully figure out how to overcome. And those challenges don't come in only certain types and not others. Those challenges are poor people, which I guess we're more familiar with what it means to not have and to really need. But a person with an excess of wealth is also an equally difficult place, because he's going to struggle with saying no, with where he should draw lines and where he should limit himself. So what's interesting is in our generation, I happen to work in the world of technology, and it's so clear that this is something that technology has brought to us. to our specific generation, is this access of information. Right. What's interesting is that if you think about it, the invention of the internet is not that there's now more information in the world. It's just that now it's more accessible. Now someone who writes an article in Africa, I can just Google it and now I have it, right? I don't have to go to Africa or even a specific library that only has these types of articles. I just have it now. So the ability to access and absorb information is on a level like nothing we've ever, the world has ever seen before. And obviously, information is in many different forms. Information in terms of music, in terms of ideas, in terms of video, in terms of political views, in terms of everything, in terms of viral anything. Cats in sweaters, in terms of beheadings that are posted on the internet, and now you could watch a terrorist behead an innocent victim. Have you all gotten one of those links once in your life? Never? Have you seen them on the internet?
No.
They post them, those sick dudes. And the whole effort, if you think about it, was it's a good thing to give the most amount of people in the world access to the most amount of information, and the more the better. That is the theory behind the internet. If we can provide people with access to more and more information, they will be more educated. They will be more capable, right? I'm sure they won't spend all their time just like texting weird emojis and just wasting their time on YouTube, right? That's not how it's going to end up. That part I'm kidding about. But there's such a wealth of information. You could literally get your degree for free. The information that I spent many thousands of dollars getting, I'm almost certain I could access every word of every textbook and every lecture that I had. I'm almost certain I could access it for free right now. It's pretty sad. It's been a while, so things have progressed to that point. I don't know if that's true back then. But you can access unbelievable, there are entire Harvard courses that are being offered for free online. They do that. Yeah. It's unbelievable. And yet there's something fundamentally wrong or lacking. Sorely lacking, and I think it's not just that it's a problem, it's that we weren't even taught to think of this as a problem, which is, what should I absorb, incorporate into myself, what should I learn, and what shouldn't I learn about? What shouldn't I Google? What shouldn't I find out about? What is it okay that I don't know about today? Because when it's there, when it's available, it becomes okay, so then I need to access it. I need to be able to see it. If it happened, if everyone does, if there's this Korean guy that made a crazy weird music video a few years ago, just dances like a weird person, and a billion people watch it, I have to eventually watch it. In my day, it was the equivalent of like seeing Titanic. That was like my seventh grade. Like, you didn't see Titanic? Everyone saw Titanic. I actually successfully didn't see Titanic. Yeah. Yeah. So, thank you. Didn't speak to me. I don't know. We're completely, as a generation, I am guilty as charged. I'm going to speak for myself. We're completely unequipped with the ability to look at this unbelievable amount of information and say what I should look at and what I shouldn't. And it's not even necessarily being taught. In marketing conferences about how to successfully market your company online, do you know the answer for, you know, how to use social media? The more that you post on social media, the better. Like, if you do 4 posts a day, it's better if you do 6. Because people are just going through everything, and if they see your ad 3 times and they see your competitor's ad 5 times, so then you just need to do more. And it's just like everyone trying to just see more, and there's just more. More, more, more. Like, it just multiply that every day by just everyone just doing more. And I hear that and I'm scared, because when are we going to figure out that this isn't good? And I don't need to necessarily point to the access of information and content that's not appropriate. I think that's more of an understood thing, but I think the... So let's go in. 1 second. Odaka. The need for us to look at our spiritual mission as something where we try and be precise, where we decide, where we are the masters of what we think about and what we do. And that's a lost art. We live in a world where lots of it is decided for us, where lots of it is, oh, everyone does this, or everyone, it's kind of, we're drawn along. And we may not even realize it. It may be subconscious. And the most religious thing you could do in your life is not to be more machmir, is not to simply remove your mind from thinking what's right and what's wrong. The most religious act you can do is to make a choice. And not only that, to make a choice to say, I'm not going to be involved in something, and instead I'm going to be involved in this other thing. If you think about it, and we'll finish right here, we just finished talking about Yaakov Avinu. And I posed this interesting comparison to students of mine all the time. Which is the one out of the twins, Yaakov and Esav, that God seemingly chose to be the father of his destined nation? Yaakov. And Esav seemed to be not part of the picture. And what was Esav's life like? We don't really talk about him much. But he had a pretty amazing life. He lived in Eretz Yisrael his whole life, that we know of. He lived with his parents, his father, of whom being the greatest man on earth for much of that time, and his mother being right up there as well. He had access to them whenever he wanted. He lived peacefully. He had no enemies that we know of. The challenges in his life, we don't hear about them. It was a pretty amazing life. He had his own nation. He had his own 400 followers. He had a whole Har Seir. It was his. He's literally a king.
But he still made bad decisions.
Yeah, but we don't see how badly any of this turned out for him. I don't know how badly. I think he was immoral. I think that's what they talk about. I think he wasn't ethical, but in terms of his wives and things. But quality of life, you know, snapshot, look at his vacation videos versus Yaakov's, you know, like, we're talking about a very high quality life. Yaakov, young age, kicked out of his home or else he would have been murdered. Went to his conniving uncle, got his wife switched up on him, had to work an extra 14 years, finally got his wife, worked another 8 years, almost got, lost all his money, came back, his beloved wife died on the way home to Israel. Right when he got there and said, finally, I could sit, his daughter's raped. And then right after that, okay, fine, problem solved, Yosef's gone. There isn't one point, and we hear this in last week's Parshan by Yechi, when Paro asked, how's your life? And he said, my years have been short and terrible. And this is the one that God loved. Now, this isn't just a lesson on how life is hard, you know, suck it up. But the point is that God wanted to put the ones he cared about in a position where they needed to make choices. Where they needed to say, I'm going to do this and not that. And what does it mean to live a life on vacation? Your brain could take a break. What does it mean to live in Eretz Yisrael next to Yitzchak and not have a worry in the world? You don't need to think much. You don't need to decide, should I do this or should I do that? every moment of Yaakov's life, I need to say, I'm going to do it this way, and I'm not going to do it that way. I'm going to involve myself in him and not in that. Think about it with Avram and Yitzchak also. Avram had to separate from Lot. Avram had to separate from his family. Avram had to always be thinking, what should I be doing in this situation? And that's our goal, to show them. If we could start to think consciously, what should I be involved in today and what not? What should I be thinking about today and what not? That is a successful avoda, that we can be involved in this season of Shovavim. And that's the idea of Shovavim. Not necessarily to think about the end result, the consequence, because the consequence really started way back when we decided or didn't decide to think properly. And hopefully by tuning our minds appropriately and properly, we can successfully begin to improve and grow and connect ourselves in a deeper way to us and to God. Yashkoch.